the dot, so I guess we'll go ahead and start. The first two articles will be presented at. I guess our theme this month is methodology papers. I always find a method may be above my head, but at least the two articles I chose, I'll try to explain them the best I can. And the first two, I'll turn over to Matt.
Thanks. So our first article here is entitled Calculating the Tumor Nuclei Content for Comprehensive Cancer Panel Testing, and the lead author is Nicobo, and was published in JTO. And so the aim of the study was to determine the accuracy of tumor cellularity estimations by pathologists compared with the calculated cellularity from sequencing results, and with the goal of trying to improve the accuracy of this estimation by a training and feedback a module. So the methods, so there was 9 pathologists involved in the study, and they evaluated the tumor cell content of 18 tumors before and after this training session. And this was all done on the same day that they evaluated the tumors. They had a training session, and then they reevaluated the same tumors. And they used a set of 7 different tumors as standards during the training session with an explanation of the analysis. In terms of the gold standard for true tumor cellularity, this was based on 2 things, the first being the mutant allele frequency as determined from the sequencing, and the cellularity determined by the pathologist at the Foundation Medicine Institute where all the sequencing was done. And importantly, that pathologist was blinded to the results of the molecular. As I mentioned, the same cases were reviewed on the same day with a washout between using in the training session, and there was different answers. And then to limit recall bias, they randomized the order of the tumors in each session. And the digital slides that they used for the training session are available online in a link through the paper if you wanted to take a look at them yourselves. So the results, so the study included 6 lung adenocarcinomas, 8 colon cancers, 1 ovarian carcinoma, 1 melanoma, 1 intrapancreatic mucinous neoplasm, and 1 anaplastic thyroid cancer. The cellularity of the tumor was determined using the allele frequency of common oncogenes and tumor suppressors, and they corrected for the mutations if these typically occur in heterozygous states. And the tumors had a calculated allele frequency between 15% and 70%. Importantly, the cutoff for the testing was 20% for the assay that they used. So in the first round of review, the pathologists had calculated a statistically significant higher cellularity from both the Foundation Medicine pathologist as well as the calculated allele frequency from the genetic testing. And there was no significant difference between the Foundation Medicine pathologist and the calculated mutant allele frequency. So then they did this training session where they kind of guided them through 7 different tumors and kind of with an explanation of how that result was come to be. And after they completed this training session, the estimated allele frequency by the outside pathologist group was not significantly different from either the Foundation Medicine or the calculated allele frequency. The one thing to point out is there's a pretty big range of tumor cellularity that was estimated by pathologists, and in many cases it actually the acceptable cellularity, which I cut off. For example, there's one case of a lung cancer that was between 2 and 80% in the range, from 3 and 60, and then one case of a colon cancer that was between 2 and 80, so fairly big range of estimation. And this range continued, but the standard deviation improved after the training session, and so that colon cancer improved to a range of 10 to 70, and the lung improved from 20 to 70. And the tumors that had the largest standard deviation in range were the colonic adenocarcinomas and pancreatic tumors. So in their kind of analysis of it, they found that in the first round, the pathologists tend to calculate tumor cellularity based largely on the amount the tissue occupied in the slide and really failed to account for additional normal cells, including lymphocytes, vessels, and fibroblasts. And this was resulting in their overestimation of the tumor cellularity. And it can be quite challenging because the nuclei for the tumor cells are often quite occupy a larger space than the surrounding lymphocytes. So this is another feature that causes the overestimation. So in conclusion, the group of pathologists tend to overestimate the tumor cellularity for molecular testing. However, training using standardized controls can improve this accuracy and to really take into account those additional normal cells that are within the tissue. And despite training, there still remains a relatively large range in what the pathologists are calling for tumor cellularity, which can span the range of acceptable cutoffs. So I think there's a role in the future here for some additional kind of machine learning type algorithms and things that can get a more unbiased way of calculating tumor cellularity, in addition to kind of some a training on how to better characterize these.
Yeah, can I ask a question?
Of course.
Yeah, you know, I'm not involved in doing this anymore. So tumor cellularity has to do with the number of cells rather than the surface area, number one. And number two, why do you need to know that information? Does that information dilute the results that you get from your testing?
So all these assays have a minimum tumor cellularity to reduce the possibility of a false negative result for mutational testing. So if it's less than the 20% cutoff, then it doesn't meet the criteria for doing the assay, because the worry is that if you less than that, say 10%, you might miss an actionable driver mutation in your genetic testing.
Can I ask a little bit about that, Matt? Because what they used as the gold standard was the actual analysis. So predicting adequate cellularity is not the same as measuring adequate cellularity, right? So I guess I'm going to circle back to Tom's question. Maybe the conclusion from this is that that's a waste of time.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think all these assays all have a calibrated assay which they're comfortable at in detecting it, and that might not be as low as they can go down. Some of the mutant allele frequencies are actually below 20%, but they still pick them up, right? I think that.
Jeff, are you saying that we should just run all the specimens and not try to predict if there's adequate cellularity? Is that kind of your question?
Well, what I'm saying is this shows that human counting has a wide range that spans what's acceptable for testing, and yet the testing itself showed that it was adequate. So it seems like if we rely only on the human predictor, that you're going to have some unnecessary false negatives and patients subjected to re-procedures that weren't really necessary. So it feels like it's some combination of a good faith estimate without too much granularity, and then analyzing the results themselves to understand whether the quantity was sufficient for testing. That's all.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to send them crap, right? Like if it's all necrotic goo, that wouldn't be very smart. But if you're thinking, gosh, I don't know if this is 20 or 30%, or I don't know if this is 15 or 20%, or I don't know if this is 5 or 15%, sounds like that's not very reliable.
Yeah, I agree. And I know that, and I would be curious to see elsewhere, here they tend to tell us to try it and rather than not try it and send a specimen through.
I can't think of a single patient who would say, what the hell, let's just do another one just in case, right? I mean, I think just try it is a reasonable strategy.
But what we do in Calgary is if it looks like it's not going, it's in the 5% range, which is our kind of threshold, 5 to 10% range, we'll run it. And if the test is negative, we'll say we can't exclude that there was a false negative.
Yeah.
We'll run it in the first place. But it's good to know that it might have been negative because there wasn't enough tissue, and that's when you say, all right, then do we need to do another biopsy?
To be honest, our lab has been working really hard to push down their QNS rates, and they're more interested in the total number of cells than a percentage. So calculating percentage is less important than having enough cells for them to take a shot.
We try to look at both. If there's enough tissue and a percentage, yeah, it's all part of the same thing. We look at all of that. Yeah.
In this study, it was mainly resection cases, so I don't think the absolute number of cells was the main problem. There was, I think, only one or two biopsy cases.
We'll do punches. If there's a pure cellular area, we'll try and punch that tissue.
Oh. That's a good idea. I don't think we
do that regularly.
Well, this is a good discussion. We'll move on to the next one.
So the next case is a rapid clinical mutational testing of KRAS, BRAF, and EGFR, a prospective comparative analysis of the IDELA platform with high throughput next-generation sequencing, and it was published, the lead author being Van Hale, in Journal of Clinical Pathology. So the aim of this study was, it's a prospective study, and they wanted to investigate the concordance between this IDELO platform, which I'll talk a bit about, and gold standard next-generation sequencing for detection of EGFR, KRAS, and BRAF mutations in non-small cell lung carcinoma, colorectal carcinoma, and melanoma. So the methods, so this is a prospective, they prospectively collected 48 cases, all from a single institution in Belgium over a six-month period back in 2017. Cases had a diagnosis of melanoma, non-small cell, or colorectal, and the inclusion criteria included that they needed required mutational testing to develop their personalized treatment plan. And they excluded cases with insufficient tissue. In cases that were discrepant between their two assays, they used a third method that used the COBOS 4800 assay through Roche at a third-party accredited laboratory. So a bit about the platform. So this IDELO platform is a fully automated system that uses cartridges, and these cartridges contain all the reagents to process tissue, so it's a closed system, and it uses a high-intensity focused ultrasound fluorescence. So ultrasound system followed by fluorescence-based PCR amplification. And it has these requirements for tissue include it needs 50% cellularity for BRAF, 10% cellularity for EGFR or KRAS, and it needs a tumor area of, it's actually fairly small, between 50 to 600 millimeters squared on a 5-micron section or only down to 25 to 300 millimeters squared on a 10-micron section in just a single one. And then the other assay that they used was an NGS sequencing assay, and this is the comparison as the gold standard that used an Illumina platform on a MiSeq or a NextSeq, and this required 6 to 12 sections to meet the requirements of 50 nanograms of DNA and a tumor percentage of 10%. And they used the hotspot mutation assay, the TruSight Tumor 26 kit through Illumina. So the results, the first thing I did was a literature review. So table one, if you're interested, shows a number of previous studies that have been all done on the IDELO platform, and most of the studies show that it has a pretty good sensitivity and specificity compared with other assays. And then in terms of this study, they had 45 formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded cases, as well as they used three cytology cases that used a cyto-rich red alcohol-based fixative. I should point out the IDELO platform works for FFP tissue, cytolite fixed tissue, as well as fresh tissue. And they detected mutations in 8 of the 13 melanoma cases, and there was no discordances with the NGS gold standard assay. They detected mutations in 9 of the 18 colorectal cancers with one discordance, and a mutation that was only detected on the IDELO platform that I'll talk a bit about in a minute. And in 6 of 17 cases of non-small cell lung carcinoma with one discordance, that was only detected on the NGS platform, which I'll talk about. So in terms of the discordant colorectal case, there was a KRAS mutation that was only identified on the IDELO platform, and it was not detected in their NGS platform or the COBOS assay. So it's not clear if this is a false positive from the IDELO platform or it's a false negative in the other assays. The other assays should detect it if it was there, but they question whether there could be some clonal population or limited in cellularity or something that limited the assay in detecting those other assays, but it's kind of impossible to say one way or the other. But the fact that the two other assays didn't detect it suggests that it could be a false positive in the IDELO platform. In terms of the discordant non-small cell lung carcinoma case, there was a rare insertion of 18 base pairs in exon 19. This is seen in around 1% of non-small cell lung carcinomas. It is a sensitizing mutation to EGFR, but the IDELO platform is not designed to detect it, so it's not one of the mutations that it detects in its assay. And then in terms of turnaround time, which I think is the selling feature for this platform, is that this assay only takes 90 to 150 minutes from the time that you put a slide into it, and it's completely, you put it in and you walk away in terms of the tech time, and then it basically puts out a result. In contrast to the NGS, which takes probably at least 3 days after you've extracted the DNA and everything. So in conclusion, this IDELO platform can provide rapid mutational testing for at least a subset of these clinical actionable mutations. I think the fact that it missed one of the non-small cell lung carcinoma one is an important point. In these rare mutations, it's not designed to detect them, so it's not going to detect them, and it's not designed to do that. So it's a way to potentially screen them, but it's not a complete large panel way of ruling out anything. And it does show a high concordance with NGS sequencing in tested mutations for non-small cell, colorectal, as well as melanoma. Any questions?
So this is a proprietary technology, right?
That's correct, yes.
And given that, I mean, would for example, Mayo ever even consider using it? You know, it's a company in Belgium. And
We are developing it. We are validating it.
So you're going to use the procedure, or you're going to send it to the company?
No, we're going to use it here. That's my understanding.
What are you going to use it for?
Well, the thing was the screening, because, you know, they say NGS for 3 days. I guess for us it's not that fast. So we haven't really talked about how we're going to use it. The only preliminary conversation we had was, well, would we put this in our frozen section, for example, and as soon as we cut a piece of tissue, we just have the machine in our frozen section and just start, you know, for whatever tumors it would be indicated, just throw it in there, and by the end of the day, with your report, you have
a mutational
status for some of the genes. And those it
looks like it's kind of a single gene assay, which doesn't work for any oncologist I know anymore. So a positive result would be actionable, but a negative result would not be, and you'd have to pursue additional testing, right?
Yeah, the understanding is I think you would have to pursue additional testing no matter what. So it's not completely clear for that reason what we're going to do. But I think oncologists, that we like the rapidity of it. So it's kind of all open for discussion. So I guess I was curious to see if anybody else had started working on it or had thought about this.
I guess the one use maybe, you know, there are quite high percentage of KRAS mutation. So if it is there, then it just rule out, you know, right there, not going further any, so it's kind of a screening, you know, screening out for further testing.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
They've only done 48 cases. That's a very small number of cases to make such a big change in your practice, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are a number of other studies, like in Table 1, they highlight, there's been a number of studies over the last 2 or 3 years that have kind of highlighted this use. This one.
Oh, with the same platform?
Correct, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I can see one problem with this is that we're trying to go towards doing NGS, collecting DNA and RNA all at once. Doing the EGFR KRAS, if they're both negative, then you don't go any further. If KRAS is positive, then you kind of think that there's no point going further, right, because it's mutually exclusive. But then if you do want to go further, you've now got your RNA and DNA collected already. So this makes me think this is quite wasteful, because you're not going to use that tissue for anything else. Whereas if you collect it for NGS, you can then go ahead and use that RNA and DNA further on.
I completely agree. You do use that one slide. It does only take the one slide, though, compared with some other assays, which often take multiple levels. So you can envision a system where you use the first slide, run the screening test. If you find something, then it's done. But if you don't, then you take your remaining slides and then do your DNA and RNA prep for your larger scale NGS library and fusion library.
I'm curious, are your oncologists content that if there's a KRAS mutation, they're done?
Well, I guess it depends who you talk to. I think that's for us at least, the challenge is sometimes it varies with the oncologist.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, same here, same everywhere, I suppose. But, you know, they'll tell me that the rate of co-mutations is just under 1%, and the most common driver in that pair is KRAS and EGFR, and they're interested. I don't think that has been shown to have any impact on overall survival, but it does affect progression-free survival and response rate. So our at least some of our oncologists wouldn't be happy to stop with KRAS as a screening strategy.
Well, if KRAS is positive, the chances of anything else are really, really low.
Right, but the chance of anything actionable in this world is really, really low, and yet it's all the craze, right?
Well, it's almost vanishingly rare. So at the moment, we're undergoing a huge financial crunch here, and we're trying to stop doing things that don't make financial sense. Yeah.
That's way more reasonable to find its way into our country's policies.
Yeah. Well, this is a good discussion. If ever we proceed and how we proceed, I guess we could have that discussion again. And if anybody else decides to take on that technology, I'll be curious to hear from you guys.
And how long does it take? Is it like an overnight test?
No, it's an hour or two.
Yeah, 90 to 150 minutes in the study.
But do you need something that fast? I mean, by the time you make your diagnosis and maybe do the odd immunostain, it's 2 or 3 days sometimes?
Yeah, I guess that's why for us the thing I could think was interesting was really in our frozen section where we could do it right then and there as we do the diagnosis. But
MC, let me ask you a question. Let's suppose you do it and an hour and a half later you have a EGFR mutation. Would then you not do a bunch of immunos?
I don't know. Probably not, I guess. I guess it would pretty much tell me. Then I would have the H&E still. I guess I wouldn't need to as much. I mean, I would do PD-L1, of course, but maybe it would help. I'm going in there blindly.
It's an interesting question. You know, would this replace other tests, or is this just another test on top of the things we already do?
I think that's really the value. For me, it would be to replace something or to really streamline instead of just adding. And I'm not clear yet. I like it third, but. Okay.
Are you talking about on lung biopsies or the tumor resection? You're talking about lung biopsies themselves.
Right, we don't have the lung biopsies at the frozen. It would be maybe tumor resection that would have a higher grade, like if they removed an intrapulmonary met, maybe, or if we happen to have a higher stage, it was a pleural met. Sometimes we get incidental, you know, they go in there a bit diagnostically also, and then you may be dealing with a higher stage tumor that you could potentially test right away. I wouldn't do it on stage 1 or 2 tumors.
Those are really rare then, aren't they? I mean, most of the time we get lung biopsies and we have to...
Right.
But you're buying this equipment for very rare occasions.
Well, there's also other tumors.
Relatively.
It's not just for lung.
Oh, not just
melanoma
lung.
Melanoma, colon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm
sorry, one final question. Did they talk about the cost of this compared to other testing?
So it's hard to find out a firm number of the cost. And it's a bit, they don't really release that. I tried to find that out, so I can't give you definitive on what the cost is, but I think it's in the same ballpark. But the problem is you don't test for the same number of mutations, right?
And I have no idea for here.
Well, oncologists have never worried about cost before anyway. So.
Okay.
It's not their budget.
Oh, exactly. The third article is not specific to lung, but it was a question we kind of grappled with here, so that's why I chose to present it. It's on the NTRK fusion detection, and here we had discussed in lung cancer if we should do screening using IHC or was IHC better than to start with than going directly to molecular testing. And then as we were discussing this paper came along, which I thought was interesting. So NTRK fusion in solid tumors is one of the more recent therapeutic target that was identified, and it's across all different tumor types. It's not specific to lung, of course. There are three different receptor genes that are called NTRK 1, 2, and 3, and they can all be involved, although NTRK 1 and 3 are probably the two most common. We were already a bit familiar with ETV6 and NTRK 3. That's not a new fusion. It was known especially in mesoblastic nephroma, secretory carcinomas of the breast and salivary glands, as well as infantile fibrosarcoma and colorectal carcinoma. but I don't know how long ago, maybe 6 months ago, maybe a little more, where we have the FDA approval of the NTRK inhibitors. So the background here is it's really what's the best way of identifying this fusion. It's not that easy because we have three different genes. There are numerous different partners. There's various breakpoints along these three different genes. And, of course, many ways that we could look for them, whether it's DNA sequencing, RNA-seq, or doing the immunostain, which is a pan-NTRK. So it's a one antibody that includes all three. It doesn't sort out NTRK 1, 2, 3, where the other assays can. So basically, MSK, what they did is they looked at reporting the sensitivity and specificity and looking at the different pitfalls for these different assays. And from January 1st, 2014 to March 30th, they had almost 39,000 tumor samples that they had tested through their impact. In their impact, they have DNA sequencing, and they also have RNA. So their DNA sequencing is a really large panel, 468 genes that includes all NTRK. Their RNA-seq, however, is not kind of a deep sequencing. It really is more a multiplex PCR where they look at 15 genes only. So the most common genes, and they included three NTRK. And basically, they use a gold standard of RNA-seq to identify the fusion of the NTRK genes. Or if they didn't have RNA-seq data, they didn't have RNA-seq data on all their cases, then they would use the DNA data as long as that NTRK fusion occurred with a known fusion partner that they could identify through their DNA mutation. And finally, they did IHC, and for them, a positive IHC was 1% of tumor cell positive in any type of staining pattern, whether nuclear, cytoplasmic, and whatever. And they didn't do it on all their cases. They had 66 confirmed cases of NTRK using their molecular, and then they had 300-400 cases that were negative controls. So basically, first of all, NTRK fusion is a rare event. So as you can see, out of their almost 39,000 samples, only 87 cases, which was 0.2%, actually had that fusion, just to make Jeff's point about how rare some of these events are. And for lung cancer, it wasn't much more. It had there was 9 lung cancer cases out of almost 4,000 tested that had that fusion, so we're talking 0.23%. In this case, they were mutually exclusive of other MAP kinase pathways alteration. And then when they identified the cases, then they compared to the DNA sequencing of their MSK impact and then with IHC. And what we could see is that the overall sensitivity, if we look at all three NTRK 1, 2, 3, we come at a sensitivity of 81%, but a very high specificity, almost 100%. And for the IHC, what they found is that when they compared the IHC, which is pan, so you can't tell which one was N1, 2, 3, but then they compared back to the individual DNA or RNA results of 1, 2, 3, what they noticed is have a fusion that involves NTRK 2, your sensitivity is 0, and that result is in the paper. And it's a better sensitivity for NTRK. I'm sorry, it was a DNA that was 0. So the sensitivity for NTRK 1 and 2 was high at 97%, but the sensitivity for NTRK 3 was a little lower at 80%. For the overall lung, the sensitivity was 88%, but with a great specificity of 100%. So overall, it's probably the largest series we're likely to see on NTRK. The only, I think, caveat is their RNA-seq is very much, it's really a PCR, multiplex PCR, so it's not deep RNA-seq looking at everything. But again, it's still probably going to remain the best reference for a while on NTRK and how it compares. The message is, of course, the gold standard remains RNA-seq, and I don't think the other methods can supplant them. It's highly specific, like using the IHC means that, of course, if you, and your stain is positive, the specificity was 100%, so you could count on it, but since the sensitivity is pretty low, it's not a great tool to screen. So I think for me the take-home message, if you're going to, you know, test your lung cancer to find a target, go straight to doing molecular, both DNA and RNA-based platforms to find your drivers, and probably not worth, you know, doing necessarily the IHC ahead in this case, I would suggest. So I don't know if there's any questions or any thoughts.
Well, this is Colby again with just sort of a off-the-wall thought. Here's a mutation that's present in about 0.2% of lung cancers. So, you know, obviously it's not zero. Does anybody know what the percentage of actionable cases of lung cancer actually get treated with personalized medicine protocols? So we have 500,000, well, we have 200,000 people that die of lung cancer in the U.S. every year, and probably 180,000 of those at some point in their career are going to have metastatic disease. Does anybody know what percentage of those will get personalized medicine? Or, Margaret, in Canada, do you know what percentage of patients who would be candidates for personalized medicine actually get it?
I would say that if we have an actionable target, they do get it. But, you know, it's only limited to our ALK positive, EGFR positives. At the moment, ROS1 is not funded by the government. So, unfortunately, it's really sad. So if you have a ROS1 mutation, you can't get treated with crizotinib, whereas if you had an ALK one, you could.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty tightly tied in, except sometimes we get oncologists and pathologists requesting things that we say, no, we're not doing that. And then the patient then has to pay, and we send it out somewhere else, and the patient will then pay for their own treatment. But that happens rarely. So I can't give you a percentage, but I'd say most of them will get treated with that actionable sequence, with that actionable target.
Because the reason that I ask, I'm at a place now where I see a lot of lung cancer, and they do about 40 immunostains on every case. And I'm not sure very many of those are even go out and are looked at for any of these personalized protocols.
It's a wild west out there.
This is Jeff. I'll try to find it, but Tom Giordano, who is the director of our molecular pathology division, sent an editorial, and I think it was in Science or maybe it was JAMA, I can't remember, but it tried to answer your question, Tom, and it was a surprisingly low number with an incredibly large spend. And I think, I don't know what the message is for pathology exactly, other than that we ought to be better stewards of the tissue and how we're using it for both immunostains and molecular testing. And I'm still skeptical about models that test every single lung cancer independent of stage. And I know all the arguments for that, but I think if we don't learn to be more effective users of the resources, someone will decide for us, because that's usually how it unfolds.
Yeah, we're not reflexing unless, you know, there's a higher stage. We don't do it unless there's a higher stage to start with.
Yeah.
I think the problem in our country, Margaret, is that the fee-for-service environment still obtains in non-hospitalized patients, and that drives a lot of behaviors.
Right.
Jeff, what do you guys do at Michigan?
it's on the oncologist order, and that's stage dependent. So we don't routinely test for any of these things without an oncologist order. And we've checked back with them multiple times as other practices have adopted other workflows, and they've been very consistent. I'm kind of proud of them. They're very practical. And they've said, you know, that result isn't meaningful for us in patients who are surgical candidates. And, you know, it's not that they don't get that surgical candidates can become patients with advanced stage disease, but they don't feel like they've lost anything in terms of testing later rather than testing now. And to me, that makes a whole lot of sense given the cost of these assays. So that's how we do it here. How do you do it there?
We wait for the oncologist to ask, but that's led to some dissatisfaction. Our oncologists don't want us to test for early stage. What they find challenging is the late stage, and this is really related to how we schedule here, because a patient won't send oncologist until the diagnosis is made.
Yeah.
And by the time they get their appointment, they see the oncologist. If you're stage 4 cancer, you might have had a third of your life expectancy that kind of was between getting your appointment, then asking for the molecular testing to be done and getting the results back, seeing the patient again, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're going to try to find a way for advanced stage only to maybe be able to do the testing. They pretty much did on all their advanced stage, I have to say. So for those reasons, I'm not sure what's going to look like yet. Reimbursement is an issue. Do you guys do all your molecular testing at Michigan, or do you send out like to Foundation or other places?
There are some rogue oncologists who occasionally send out to Foundation, but we've managed to rein in most of that, and so the vast majority is done here. But I take your point. I think workflows haven't really caught up with the paradigm, and that includes when you order those tests. But I'm glad to hear you, at least your goal is to do it in patients with advanced stage, although I also get that the clock is ticking in a pretty urgent manner by that stage in their story. So I think figuring that out is the hard part.
My point had to do with people who were seen at like the county hospital somewhere and who are underinsured. A lot of these people are never even going to get close to this kind of testing.
Yeah. Although the National Quality Foundation has as an initiative molecular biomarker testing in lung cancer patients, and that was a pretty vigorous debate that included patients in the room, and I think there'll be some recommendations that will address accessibility for everyone.
And we try to reflect if it's a higher stage, and we try to work out from the clinical history. And sometimes the clinicians know already, and they'll say, please do biomarker testing if this is cancer, et cetera. So we're trying to get that, you know, narrow that gap of when the patient sees an oncologist, they've already got the result.
Yeah. That's good. Okay. So the fourth article is, we're probably tired of hearing about PD-L1, but I like this article because, first of all, they did a very large review of the literature, so I thought it would be nice for people to have kind of that reference at hand. It's very exhaustive because, of course, their goal was to do a meta-analysis. And also their question, what they were trying to answer is, and that's very important for laboratories, can you do an LTD to replace your FDA-approved assay? There's kind of cost-related issues sometimes for that, and that's really the question they were trying to answer.
What is an LTD?
Lab developed test.
Okay.
Yeah. And I won't try to explain the methods. I have to say for this article, the methods were a little above my head, but they really did an exhaustive search of the literature. They were looking for any studies that actually had comparative that the goal of the studies had been to look at a FDA-approved test in an LTD. Often there was more than one test studied in each study, and they really wanted to be able to answer the question of sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive value, and negative predictive value. And they even reached out to authors if there's some data points that were missing in the papers to try to get at those to be able to do their various statistical methods. And they defined as clinically acceptable, and that was kind of a bit of an arbitrary decision they made. They just decided that they would consider something clinically acceptable if the sensitivity and specificity was 90% and greater. And again, if you pull the table, it gives you kind of really all the comparison points of all the studies for each of the various assays that are FDA approved versus what different laboratories have tried in terms of developing their own assay. And I think the take-home message was kind of important. One is you can do a good LTD, and you could use an LTD to study PD-L1. And that was one question that was always out there, whether or not you could do that. And their conclusion is you can. And I think the best clone for which you could get a good LTD was a 22C3, which is the one we use the most for Pembro. The other point they made, which was kind of interesting, especially in light of a lot of the studies that actually compared the various clones to one another in terms of being able to use various clones to interchange, and what they suggested based on their data is that we shouldn't do that. So if your goal is to be able to give Pembro, that you should either use the FDA 22C3 or use an LTD for 22C3. Don't use the Ventana SP263. The comparisons are not favorable when you do that. So even if they're two FDA approved, and even if you have those worked up using one interchangeably for the clinical question posed or for the clinical context would not be appropriate based on their analysis.
MC, can I ask you just so that I make sure I understand, when you talk about an LDT using 22C3, so 22C3 is the FDA-approved reagent, but you're saying you could run that on a different platform?
Yes.
Okay. And isn't – I thought one of the drivers for using – an LDT was the cost of the 22C3 reagent.
I'm going to turn it over to Anya if she's still there. I guess she's not. She knows.
Okay.
Or the questions for that.
Calgary was part of a study looking at that, and it was the cost. Yeah, it was related to the cost as well. Yeah.
So what they asked for the FDA testing is the platform. DACOLINK 48 or something, you know, that's going to by itself is a several hundred thousand dollars, I heard. And that is not even good one. You know, that's not top of the line kind of a thing. And
yeah.
People are shaking their heads. Why? You know, it has to be that platform. So that's the main issue, I think. The reagent may be that, but FDA is with a DACOLINK 48, but, you know, the main thing is we don't need to use that one. The Ventana or other platform that is already used in the lab can be used. That's the LDT, you know.
Thank you, Joanne.
Before we had to use the three commercial labs that they have that DACOLINK, whatever that thing, you know. So we don't want to buy a platform for one antibody, you know.
We did.
I don't know. I don't think we did in the end.
Didn't.
I cannot begin to describe how much I hate PD-L1.
Yeah. I know. I won't bring it up again. But there was tons of references. I figured that might be the last of it. We're coming to the hour. I think this month there was several interesting paper. I just want to point out that we have a mesothelioma paper out there that was in JTO that is a consensus paper on how to do by subspecialty better in terms of changing how we practice. And, of course, there was a lot of recommendation for pathology, and it will be interesting to see how much of what's in that paper makes it into the new WHO. So I think it's at least a paper to be aware of. There was another nice, interesting little paper by Natasha, who is disputing the diagnosis of pneumocytic adenomyoepithelioma as a true lung neoplasm. Her paper suggests that these may be all either primary or metastatic myoepithelial tumors that happen to have an exuberant proliferation of reactive pneumocytes. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And finally, the other thing that was I thought was interesting in terms of practice at the frozen section was the radiomics paper in the frozen section, how they use that information to try to guide the surgeon in terms of trying to be as accurate. We know that there's limitation with the frozen section sometimes on making an accurate diagnosis of AIS or MIA, and how combining maybe the frozen section diagnosis and the radiology diagnosis and trying to guide the surgeon's hand in terms of deciding if the surgeon does a lobectomy or a more limited resection. So those were another couple of papers that I would just bring to your attention that I personally felt were interesting reads also. If there's no other questions or comments, I think that sums up our journal club.
Thank you, Angie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.